Hello, and welcome to the Women's Hour. I'm Kelly Pyle, your Sun Sounds of Arizona volunteer broadcaster. Today's show features articles from the July 25th and August 11th editions of People Magazine, as well as the July issue of Women's Health. A few of the articles that I'll be sharing today include Ozzy Osbourne, The Wild Life and Tragic Death of a Rock God, The Complicated Legacy of Wrestling's Top Banana, and The Truth Hiding in Women's Brains. Ozzy Osbourne, 1948 to 2025. The Wild Life and Tragic Death of a Rock God. The Prince of Darkness pioneered both heavy metal and reality TV and became one of pop culture's most beloved father figures, by Rachel DeSantis from People Magazine. In a moment years in the making, Ozzy Osbourne was sitting atop a bat-bedecked throne, performing for 40,000 people in his native Birmingham, England. "You have no idea how I feel," Osbourne, whose hard-rocking catalog helped put heavy metal on the map in the 1970s, told the crowd on July 5th, when he played a farewell concert with Black Sabbath. "Thank you from the bottom of my heart." It was an emotional homecoming for the British star, who seamlessly bridged the gap between menacing Black Sabbath frontman and foul-mouthed but soft-hearted family man on MTV's The Osbournes. And a fitting farewell. Just 17 days later, Osbourne, who had battled Parkinson's disease for more than two decades, was dead. There was a point when we were all clapping and crying, and he was trying to get out of that throne, trying to stand up, says Lizzie Hale, whose band Hailstorm also played at the concert. "That's the beauty of music. I bet you that he could fly in that moment. I think that was exactly how he wanted to end this chapter." To play the show, a determined Osbourne undertook months of training to build strength. It brought his career full circle, a source close to the family says. Osbourne died on July 22nd at age 76 in Buckinghamshire, England. Despite his illness, the star's death was a surprise. Just days earlier, his daughter Kelly, 40, had assured fans that Osbourne was not dying and slammed rumors that he and wife Sharon, 72, had made a suicide pact. Authorities said an emergency air ambulance was dispatched to the Osbournes' home and medics provided advanced critical care to the rocker, whose cause of death had not been confirmed at press time. Ozzy's final days were spent in England, surrounded by family, music, and in the place he called home, the source says. He was at peace. Sharon's deepest hope was fulfilled. The source adds that Sharon is heartbroken, but very proud of the life the family built together. "There's a lot of pain, but also a lot of comfort from the family time that they got to enjoy up until the very end." Osbourne's rise was a quintessential rags-to-riches story. Born John Michael Osbourne, he grew up poor, turning to petty theft to make ends meet. After a stint in prison, Osbourne, a self-proclaimed Beatles fanatic who credited She Loves You with inspiring him to become a musician, sought refuge in music. In 1965, he began singing with local bar bands, though he never dreamed it would be a career, he told People in 1981. It was just a way to get out of holding a job. It would be one of the only jobs Osborne would ever know. In 1968, he and three friends formed Black Sabbath. After releasing their self-titled debut 2 years later, the rockers earned a devoted following that would stick by them for the next 5 decades and propel them into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in 2006. Osborne was inducted as a solo artist in 2024. Hits like Iron Man and Paranoid helped Black Sabbath gain mainstream fame, as did Osborne's persona as an outrageous, stunt-pulling frontman with a knack for drawing the ire of conservative groups. Nicknamed the Prince of Darkness, he would regularly ask for 10 pounds of raw liver on concert nights so he could toss it to his zealous fans. Black Sabbath fought back against accusations of devil worship, which Osborne later dismissed as a marketing invention by his record label. "Ozzy is just a character," he told People in 1981. "Does Laurence Olivier have to convince people he is not Hamlet at home?" Offstage, though, a different set of demons, substance abuse, took hold. "I can do absolutely nothing in moderation," he told People in 1981. "If it's booze, I drink the place dry. If it's drugs, I take everything and then scrape the carpet for little crumbs." By 1979, his vices led to him being ousted from the very band he'd co-founded. Osborne, who got sober in 2013, was at first unmoored without his bandmates, but eventually turned things around with the help of his manager-turned-wife, Sharon. She helped steer Osborne's solo career, which began in 1980 with the chart-topper Crazy Train. With Sharon, Osborne also found a domestic footing he'd never quite reached with his first wife, Thelma Riley, with whom he shared kids Jessica, Lewis, and Elliot. But his debauched persona remained intact. When he and Sharon wed in 1982, Osborne said, "I do," in a pair of custom things. Their marriage was at times turbulent. Osborne was arrested for attempted murder in 1989 after nearly choking Sharon to death while under the influence of drugs and alcohol. She later dropped the charges and he sought treatment. And they split briefly in 2016 after he confessed to an affair. "But the pair never gave up on each other," Sharon told People in 2022. "I mean, I wasn't a saint. Ozzy wasn't a saint. I gave him as good as he gave me. We're just meant to be," said Osborne on his podcast last year. "I love her more than anything in the world." Osborne continued to tour and churn out solo records well into his 70s, even rejoining Black Sabbath for a 2013 album. But his fame reached new heights in the early 2000s with the runaway success of the groundbreaking reality show The Osbournes, which cemented his legacy. The series chronicled the dysfunctional day-to-day of Osborne, Sharon, and their two youngest children, Jack, now 39, and Kelly, with Osborne serving as a Danny Tanner type, had the Full House patriarch been dipped in a vat of acid. I've become everybody's American father, and I'm not even American, he joked to Entertainment Weekly in 2002 of the show, which became MTV's all-time highest-rated series at the time. Though the family, oldest daughter Amy, 41, opted out, was often filmed arguing, the show's undercurrent was one of love. They're the best parents I know, Kelly said during the show's run. When the series lifted the curtain on Osborne's life offstage, there was one thing that never made the cut. His 2003 Parkinson's diagnosis, which he only shared publicly in 2020. In his later years, Osborne struggled with his health. Though he relished being a grandfather to his 10 grandchildren, he remained determined to return to music, even as Parkinson's affected his mobility and speech. With his final show, he said goodbye on his terms. It's really where I belong. It's the only thing I know how to do. The relationship I have with my audience is the biggest love affair of my life, Osborne told People in 2022. I am determined to get back on stage, even if I have to be nailed to a board and wheeled on. Survival is my legacy. With additional reporting by Pernilla Sedenheim and Alex Ross. Reality TV royalty. There was never any mistaking Ozzy Osbourne for your run-of-the-mill suburban dad. I'm like, hey, if you throw on a baseball hat, you could totally blend in, his son Jack once said, and he'll just go, F you, I'm a rock god. Over 52 episodes of The Osbournes, though, he sure played the part. The show, considered MTV's first reality sitcom, paved the way for the likes of the Kardashians and transformed Osbourne's legacy as fans saw the star at home, cleaning up after the family's many dogs or calling on his son for help getting the television to work. The family even kept the camera rolling during difficult times, including Sharon's 2002 colon cancer diagnosis. The show was a cultural phenomenon and won an Emmy, but Osborne called it quits after just 3 years and 4 seasons, saying in 2020 that the level of fame brought on by the show was too much. He told NME, I said to Sharon, I don't like the way it makes me feel, and I can't stand effing cameraman in my house. I'm not upset that I did it, but I wouldn't want to do it again. People were going, aren't you worried about losing your fans? I said, I'm not worried about losing my fans. I'm worried about losing my effing mind. Though Sharon has said that Osborne never watched an episode, she told People in 2022 that she considered the show the best video diary for their grandkids. It's the greatest gift to pass down. Humble beginnings to rock fame. Birmingham boy. Osborne said he would have done anything to escape his poor upbringing. Spooky origins. Black Sabbath, Bill Ward, Tommy Iommi Osborne, and Geezer Butler were named for a 1963 horror film. Going solo. I had a craziness building up inside of me that I had to release, said the star in 1989. Metal moment. Osbourne and Black Sabbath were inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in 2006. Getting his flowers. Osbourne won 5 Grammys most recently in 2023. You have been listening to Ozzy Osbourne, 1948 to 2025, The Wild Life and Tragic Death of a Rock God, from People. Lindsay Lohan and Jamie Lee Curtis, thank God it's Friday again. Reuniting more than 2 decades after their comedy hit Freaky Friday, the stars reflect on their lasting friendship and how they've changed. By Jason Sheeler, photographs by Alexei Lubomirsky. This is a People magazine exclusive. On a vast soundstage on the Disney lot in Burbank, Jamie Lee Curtis and Lindsay Lohan are experiencing a little deja vu. It's the day after they wrapped shooting on the long-awaited sequel, Freakier Friday, in theaters, August 8th, and they have come back to work one final day for their People cover shoot. But in keeping with the mysticism of the body-swapping 1972 book by Mary Rodgers, which spawned Curtis and Lohan's hit 2003 adaptation, Freaky Friday, Jodie Foster had her 1976 version too, there is some woo-woo happening. "It's so weird," Lohan says, as she enters the hangar-sized space. "It just hit me. This is where we came for our makeup test on the first movie." Curtis adds, "It feels like home." Lohan nods. Life is so full circle sometimes. Of course, Lohan and Curtis are no strangers to studio lots such as this one. Curtis, the daughter of screen idols Tony Curtis and Janet Leigh, found fame at age 19 in the Halloween franchise and is now enjoying an Oscar and Emmy-winning renaissance in films and television. New York-born Lohan launched her career at 12 with a different Disney remake, The Parent Trap, before starring in films like Mean Girls as a teen and recently making her own return to the spotlight in a series of chart-topping Netflix rom-coms. But more than 2 decades after Freaky Friday, the mother-daughter vibes remain. Lohan said they never left. "Jamie was with me at a time in my life when I was going through a lot publicly," she says. "She was privately really there for me. I can trust her." People rejoined Curtis, 66, and Lohan, 39, this spring, just before they promoted Freakier Friday at CinemaCon in Las Vegas. In a dressing room deep beneath Caesar's Palace, as Lohan shows Curtis video of her 2-year-old son, Luai, whom she's raising with her husband, Bader Shamas, between the U.S. and Dubai, starting to talk, they sure sound like family. Fans have been waiting for this reunion for a long time. What took so long to get back together? Jamie Lee Curtis. "Well, Lindsay and I have been in each other's lives since we made that movie. That is first and foremost." Lindsay Lohan. "It's the most important thing, I think." Curtis. "And everybody I've ever spoken to has asked, will there be a Freaky Friday sequel? When I went all around the world for Halloween Ends in 2022, every stop they asked. And the answer was, Lindsay has to be old enough to have had a teenager. So then, obviously, Lindsay had this beautiful baby. She came and visited me, brought the baby. At this moment, we started really seriously talking about it. Of course, Lindsay, your son, Luai, is only 2. But this being the freaky universe, there are some real parallels with your lives. Lohan, when we started shooting the original, I was 15, about to turn 16. And Curtis, and I had a 15-year-old daughter at home. And now Julia Butters, who plays Lindsay's daughter in the film, is 16. It's so wild. Lindsay, your entire return to Disney has been some deja vu, right? Lohan, well, I went back to the lot. When I went back to the lot, it all hit me. This is where I was when I was almost 10 years old, auditioning for Parent Trap, and it changed my life. It felt surreal, but it felt right. I was like, this is the right time in my life to be back here. I have a family. I can share it all with them. The first film came out in 2003. Lindsay, you were 17. Jamie, you were 44. Can you compare your off-screen lives between now and then? Lohan, I'm at ease in my life because I've lived. I feel like such a long life at such a young age. I feel wiser now and very settled. I've become such a positive person. It annoys my husband sometimes. He's like, you have to see the real stuff. I don't have to, though. I'm going to think of the positive side. Curtis, and I'm telling you, this girl focuses at work. She's absolutely spot on. But the minute they say, okay, you can have 5 minutes, she's like, want to see the baby cam? We're both comfortable in our own skin. And in my life, in all of the great ways that being old and sober and having let go of all of my vanity or much of it, I have really been able to just let it rip in my work for now, the last 5 or 6 years. A big theme of this film is motherhood in many forms. Is there a time in your life when you began to see your mother in yourself? Curtis, I vowed not to be my mother, and yet found myself so very much the same. I followed in her exact footsteps. We have all become our mothers, but I have a freedom to be myself that my mother's generation never would have allowed. I've accepted myself. She would have been incredibly upset at everything, everywhere, all at once, and how I looked. My mother would have loathed. Lohan, don't say that, though, because you never know. Curtis, I do know, because her generation was so much about your body and what you look like and the beauty. The beauty is just who she was. That's what her life was. My mother was literally jaw-dropping. But I think that would have been very hard for her to see me with my tummy sticking out, or in The Last Showgirl, for her to see me in that dressing room at 66 years old. That really would have upset her. I know her very well. I have accepted myself in a much bigger way than I think she felt she was allowed to in her generation. Lohan, I always ask my husband, am I like my mom? And he says, yes, your mannerisms are a lot like her. I think it's a very New York thing. Like, I was raised very New York, and my mom is very New York. But also her maternal sense. She's very close with all of her kids. I think I'm more protective than she is. But she started in dance, and she put me in tap dance and ballet because she was a ballerina. So dance classes for your son soon? Lohan laughs. He loves dance time in the morning. Right now, he's just running everywhere, and I need to get that under control. It's apparent that there would be no Freakier Friday if not for your friendship. Curtis, I know I can trust her. I can't say that about a lot of people. I do know that if I tell her something, it's going to stay with her. We've both been through hard things, because we're alive and life is hard, and we're not dead yet. So the truth of our experience together, it belies all of the kind of show busy stuff. We connected, and we really stayed connected, and that is special and rare for me. Lohan, safe is a very important word to me. I have to feel safe around people. And Jamie is one of those people for me. Like, I feel very safe with you. I feel safe telling you things. So it's, I know you said trust, but for me, it's safe. Curtis, and I'm sure I drive you insane. I talk too much. Lohan, but that's what my mom does too. Curtis, so Lindsay Lohan, 20 years from now, freakiest Friday, you in? Lohan, I'm in. You've been listening to Lindsay Lohan and Jamie Lee Curtis, Thank God It's Friday, again, a People Magazine exclusive. You are listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona with your volunteer broadcaster, Kelly Pyle, and this is the Women's Hour. Hulk Hogan, 1953 to 2025, the complicated legacy of wrestling's top banana. An 80s icon who created Hulkamania, the pro wrestling legend sparked controversy in his later years, by Eileen Finan from People. Hulk Hogan was an oiled 6'7" bronze giant for many kids in the 80s, including a young Dwayne Johnson. You sold out every arena and stadium across the country, on your way to becoming the greatest of all time, Johnson wrote in a tribute to his childhood hero, whom he later faced in the ring as The Rock. A masterful showman and star of the era's exploding pro wrestling circuit, Hogan died July 24th at his home in Clearwater, Florida, at the age of 71. Following a series of health challenges, including more than 25 surgeries to address the beating his body had taken over the years. In the mid-80s, he helped take the sport mainstream and made millions of fans. No matter where we went, it was insane, Hogan's friend and manager, Jimmy Hart, told People. It was like traveling with Elvis Presley. But years later, Hogan's legacy was tarnished by a series of scandals, and his following was fractured by his support of President Donald Trump, who, in a post after Hogan's death, called him a great friend and MAGA all the way. Born Terry Bollea and raised in Tampa, by his construction foreman father and dance teacher mother, he began fighting under the names Terry Boulder and the Super Destroyer before being recruited in 1979 by wrestling promoter Vince McMahon and cast in the ring as an Irish villain. Hulk for his bulk, 320 pounds at his peak, and Hogan for his supposed Celtic roots. Before long, he was reborn as an American hero. People dubbed him America's best-loved muscle man, boasting inside the ring and out. "What you gonna do when Hulkamania runs wild on you?" he'd shout into the camera, his straw blonde hair and horseshoe mustache quivering with energy. In his heyday, the Hulkster, who appeared in 15 films, hawked breakfast cereal, deodorant, and more than 300 branded products. On some Saturdays, he was on TV Morning, in animated form, on his rock and wrestling cartoon, and Night on the World Wrestling Federation's Saturday Night's main event. He had spent time backstage with kids, telling them, "Let me see your muscles. I need energy from you to help me win tonight." But even his catchphrase, "Say your prayers and eat your vitamins," straddled a line between hero and huckster, since Hogan had his own brand of kids' vitamins. Hogan weathered a hit in 1993 when he was accused of using steroids. He later admitted taking them for more than a decade. But by the 2000s, he pivoted to reality TV. Hogan Knows Best featured his wife Linda and kids Brooke and Nick. But after it ended in 2007, Linda filed for divorce, accusing him of having an affair with their teen daughter's adult friend, and Nick served a jail sentence for reckless driving. In 2012, Hogan sued the website Gawker for releasing a sex tape of him with his friend's wife, and 3 years later, a recording was released of the wrestler using the N-word to describe his daughter's black boyfriend. Hogan's appearance at the 2024 Republican National Convention, tearing his t-shirt and declaring his hero a gladiator, further divided fans. Hogan apologized for the racial slur, but he remained divisive. "At home, though, he always has been my best friend," his son Nick wrote on Instagram 2 days after he died. "And I love him and miss him more than I could ever explain." With reporting by Sean Newman, this has been The Complicated Legacy of Wrestling's Top Banana from People Magazine. Sex, Drugs, and the Pursuit of Health. Meet the unapologetically pink entrepreneur who took the pharmaceutical world by storm with a simple concept. A satisfying sex life is essential to living a long and happy one. By Lindsay Geller. Cindy Eckert first learned about hypoactive sexual desire disorder, HSDD, the most common type of sexual dysfunction in women, while attending a conference as a co-founder of Slate Pharmaceuticals, a male hormone company. At the time, Slate's main drug was a testosterone treatment. During a presentation, scientists showed brain scan images comparing how women with normal desire and women with HSDD reacted to erotic materials. The condition is described by the American Sexual Health Association as the absence of sexual fantasies and thoughts, and/or desire for or receptivity to sexual activity that causes the person distress or difficulties. Cindy compared HSDD to a light switch in the brain that can essentially shut off libido. The proof was in the pictures. Women with the condition had very little to no activation in the pleasure centers of the brain compared to women with normal desire. Here it was in black and white, but everyone sat there looking at their phones, Cindy said. She glanced around at the group and wondered, well, who's doing something about this? As the old adage goes, if you want something done right, or in the case of women's sexual health at all, you got to do it yourself. A self-proclaimed science nerd, Cindy was drawn to the field of sexual health because it was a relatively new concept, ripe for discovery. Despite the taboo nature of her work, she loved that the findings made a real difference in people's lives. From the moment I stepped into the male sexual health space, my fascination was, this matters in someone's overall life experience, she says. Sex is an integral part of the human experience, and when you can improve that for somebody, it's the highest reward. But seeing those images at the conference and realizing that no one else seemed to care spurred Cindy to ask the obvious. She says, how can we have as many as 26 FDA-approved medications for men to lead a more satisfying sex life and not a single one for women? I knew, based on the data, more women than men actually struggle with sexual dysfunction. About half of women, 40 to 50%, will at some point in their life suffer from at least one of the four main types of sexual dysfunction: desire disorders, arousal disorders, orgasm disorders, and pain disorders. The most prevalent is HSDD, affecting about 10% of women, predominantly those age 45 and older. In fact, nearly 42% of women report a drop in sexual desire during perimenopause. Meanwhile, erectile dysfunction, the main type of sexual dysfunction in men, affects up to 14% of men under age 40, increasing to about 52% between ages 40 and 70. For Cindy, the issue is also personal. She'd struggled with symptoms of HSDD, as well as with the lack of treatment options. Here I was running a company for men to lead more satisfying sex lives and missing out on having one of my own, she says. I wanted that part of myself back, but I was dismissed when I brought up the concern to my OBGYN. She was told it was a psychological problem, and the solution was to light candles, practice mindfulness, just relax. HSDD took a toll on her relationship, which ended, and on her self-confidence as well. I had accepted that dim reality, she says. But when she saw the numbers and the science on that screen, lightning struck. Cindy spent the next year working with the best sexual medicine doctors in the world and listening to female patients share their experiences. They came from all walks of life, but every person's story at some point was exactly the same, she recalls. I thought, that's me. I'm them. This is the same struggle. Despite being in happy relationships, these women had little to no sexual desire. When they were intimate with their partners, it often took the form of mercy sex because they loved their partner and wanted them to feel pleasure even though the women weren't experiencing any themselves. The worst part? They didn't know why they felt this way. And all of the so-called solutions, date nights, relaxing bubble baths, etc., didn't work. Those real talk conversations were Cindy's secret fuel as she sold Slate Pharmaceuticals, founded Sprout Pharmaceuticals, and began the grueling 6-year FDA approval process for Addie, the first medication designed to treat HSDD in premenopausal women. She was determined that she and all those other women would be taken seriously for what they knew what was happening to them biologically, not psychologically. HSDD is believed to be caused by a chemical imbalance in the brain, not unlike anxiety and depression. And flibanserin, the active ingredient in Addie, impacts mood. That's how it was first discovered. It was a mood drug that had an interesting side effect in that it made you think about sex, Cindy says. The way that flibanserin works in the brain is not fully understood, but it's believed to interact with serotonin receptors, increasing the release of dopamine and norepinephrine, both of which play a role in sexual response and behavior. I am a firm believer that women's biggest sex organ is here, she says, pointing to her temple. Many antidepressants and anti-anxiety medications, such as Lexapro, Zoloft, and Prozac, are selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors, SSRIs, which primarily work by increasing serotonin, but can also have an indirect effect on dopamine. That 1-2 punch is known to decrease sex drive, one of the most common side effects of SSRIs. So the theory goes that because flibanserin appears to act on those neurotransmitters in the opposite way, it would have the opposite effect. As Cindy and her team began developing Addie, which she dubbed the Little Pink Pill, the hyper-feminine hue also became her armor. Challenging the status quo was not easy, even with a track record. I'd built a successful company in men's sexual health, yet everyone would pat me on the shoulder and almost in a sing-song voice say, "Oh, the little pink pill, that's cute," she says. It was so obvious what was embedded in that, making it trivial, the perceived weakness of femininity. Her unapologetically pink outlook began to form, almost turning into a battle cry. She started wearing pink every day, and the shade became brighter and bolder with each subsequent FDA hearing for Addie. She didn't care if they didn't take her seriously at first. She would no longer be ignored. Now when she wears pink, she feels as if she's suiting up to go on mission. That mission? To empower women. It's you getting to live your life on your own terms with complete agency over your pleasure, Cindy says. That proud pink stance wasn't her natural inclination. Like many women, Cindy had absolutely no sex education growing up, she says. Her father worked for the State Department, and she moved so much that she was in a different school every year from fourth grade through high school. No chance I was getting clear messaging on sex, she says, other than the societal narrative that pleasure is a man's to receive and a woman's to deliver. She sees firsthand the lasting effects of this notion. Whenever she meets someone new, say at a cocktail party, and they ask what she does, she watches their reaction carefully as she explains her work with Adyi. If it's a male-female couple, the woman kind of shuts down like, "Oh yeah, okay, I don't need that." And the man leans forward and goes, "Can I take it?" she says. You see societal conditioning in a snapshot. The woman's like, "I'm not supposed to talk about this." And the man's like, "I am entitled to this." That might explain why, although Adyi received FDA approval and came on the market in 2015, you haven't heard much about it. It tells you how deeply embedded this is culturally, the daring to talk about women's sexual pleasure. Adyi was immediately dubbed the female Viagra, and for better or worse, mostly for worse, per Cindy, the moniker stuck. In a way, you think the comparison is amazing. This can be as transformative for women's health as Viagra was for men's. But it also sets up the wrong notion of how desire works for women, Cindy says. Sex for women is not the performative act. It's about being in the headspace of feeling sexy, being interested, responding to your partner or to other cues. We're brain flow, not blood flow. The comparison to Viagra also epitomizes the double standard that Cindy has spent a decade trying to dismantle. The atrocity of women's health is that we're not taken seriously, and it shows up in so many ways, she says. First, it shows up in the regulatory cue, where there's a double standard to get an approval. Viagra was deemed to meet such an important unmet medical need that the FDA fast-tracked the review process and approved it in less than 6 months. Despite having 3 times as many patients' worth of data proving the efficacy of Adyi, Cindy says, it spent 6 years in the regulatory queue waiting for approval. That double standard also shows up in advertising guidelines. Hypoactive sexual desire disorder contains the word sex, the horror, whereas erectile dysfunction does not. When we first put up ads, they were all taken down, Cindy says. Even now, you'll find Adyi commercials, mostly on podcasts, with a female-leaning audience, not on national TV, in clear contrast to the onslaught of ads for mail-order generic Viagra. Last but not least, the double standard shows up in the medical establishment. Perimenopausal women are the largest demographic using Adyi, a patient group that has been, until recently, largely ignored, undermined, and misdiagnosed. Right now, Adyi is an FDA approved only to treat premenopausal women, but Cindy just received word that it's been fast-tracked for approval in postmenopausal women in the U.S., which is a promising sign. Whether officially diagnosed with HSDD or not, women in perimenopause tend to face the same struggles: mood imbalances, libido shifts, weight gain, and sleep disturbances. Adyi works on every single one of those things, Cindy says, adding that it does so without hormones. For women who can't use vaginal estrogen or hormone replacement therapy for other medical reasons, Aggie can be a boon. But the comparison to Viagra has almost allowed the medical community to not understand how Aggie works, she says. Sometimes I'll sit in a room with physicians and say, "Tell me how it works." They don't know that it's brain chemistry. To be clear, progress has been made. Today, you can't pass a board exam to be an OBGYN or urologist without answering a question about Aggie. Still, Cindy dreams of the day when doctors ask about sexual satisfaction as a routine part of a woman's annual checkup. The long-term goal is changing what the medical establishment prioritizes from the top down. Cindy views the advocacy work she's done with Aggie as part of a larger healthcare revolution. Women are now like, "I'm going to demand the care I deserve," she says. The female population is challenging the medical establishment. It's finally happening. Medicine's following their lead, not the other way around. At the front of that invigorated pack, Cindy, their pink-suited entrepreneurial leader, who'll never stop talking about his women's rights to understand that better sex and true desire are part of her overall wellness. You've been listening to Sex, Drugs, and the Pursuit of Health from Women's Health Magazine. Jason Momoa, This Is My Destiny. The star says honoring his Hawaiian ancestors in his new series, Chief of War, is the greatest moment of my career, by Brianne Tracy from People Magazine. As he sits down to talk about his new Apple TV Plus historical drama, Chief of War, at the Four Seasons Oahu in Hawaii, Jason Momoa is not far from where he was born, and 2 miles from where he'd spent summers with his father Joseph while visiting from Iowa, where he was raised by his mother Connie. His own kids, Lola, 18, and Nakoa Wolf, 16, whom he shares with ex-wife Lisa Bonet, are out on the ocean nearby canoeing with his dad. And so the show, which tells the epic history of the Hawaiian Islands at the turn of the 18th century, is deeply personal to the Game of Thrones and Aquaman star 46. "I feel like this is my destiny," he says. "It's beyond pinch me, it's punch me in the face." You co-created this series. What moments make you feel like this is what you were meant to be doing? "I feel like this whole thing has chosen me in a way. My dad is a coach at an outrigger canoe club, which is where I learned how to surf. Just this morning, the sand pulled back and revealed massive petroglyphs, ancient sandstone carvings, right in the place where I grew up. It's kind of insane. I've never experienced that before." What would young Jason think of Chief of War? I think we, he and co-creator Thomas Paasibet, made it for young Jason. When I'd think of The Last of the Mohicans or Dances with Wolves, those are things that you identify with being Native. I'd always go, "Wow, that would be cool one day to have something like that." We all grew up with these stories, but it was a matter of needing to wait until our careers got to a point where we could have a little more control. To play my ancestors is a responsibility. It's scary and exciting. You star in the show, serve as an executive producer, and directed the final episode. What was it like wearing so many hats? I mean, I really feel like I'm born for that. I kind of thrive in chaos. If I'm just acting, you'll also catch me playing music. I enjoy having many things happening, and I love being responsible for making the choices and having the vision. There's actually a bit of calm within all that because I'm exactly where I'm supposed to be. How special was it getting to host Black Sabbath's farewell show on July 5th? Momoa spoke with people prior to lead singer Ozzy Osbourne's death on July 22nd. To be at Sabbath, that's another 13-year-old Jason moment going like, wow. Getting to hang out with all my music rock gods and different friends was just pinch me. I'm not going to lie to you. July has been like bang, 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 bang. Then my birthday is August 1st, which is when Chief of War comes out. It's also the first day I'm filming Dune Part 3. The come down is going to be brutal. This has been Jason Momoa. This is my destiny. From People. Thanks for joining us today for the Women's Hour. My name is Kelly Pyle, and I am your Sun Sounds of Arizona volunteer broadcaster. I hope you enjoyed the show today and make plans to join us again next week, where we spend an hour together listening to articles from women's magazines. And don't forget, you can take Sun Sounds with you. You can stream it, as well as access shows on demand on our new Sun Sounds of Arizona apps for both Apple and Android. Have a great day, and be sure to stay tuned to Sun Sounds of Arizona.